This is an ABC podcast.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
There are all sorts of factors that influence where you buy or build a home. Maybe it's how close to work or family the house is. It's whether or not it has a good view, or maybe you want to be close to the shops or as far away from the shops as possible. Maybe it simply comes down to price. But how much thought do we give to climate risk and environmental impact of where we live and build? From habitat destruction and threatened species like the little earless dragon, the little lizard that was just discovered, to flood, fires and coastal erosion. Do we consider the environment enough when we build? Good morning. My name's Rochelle Hunt, your co-host this morning. Bronwyn O'Shea joining you from ABC Wodonga. Bron, it was only a few weeks ago there was a really big debate over the discovery of a lizard thought extinct, but now hundreds of thousands of homes are on hold. So is the debate as simple as who needs the home more, right? A lizard or a human? Or is the debate bigger than that? You know, do we need to cast the lens wider and consider our environmental impacts when we build?
Yeah, it's tricky, isn't it? It's a balancing act. It comes down to balancing our need for housing and affordable housing with, you know, those needs of the environment, but also our climate responsibility. You know, whether it is the threatened lizard that pops up right where a new development was planned, or thinking about that risk of building in, say, flood-prone areas. Because, Rochelle, we know that governments spend billions of dollars on disaster recovery. So do we need to rethink or even have tougher new laws on where people can and can't build and rebuild? Because so maybe, I know a whole lot of planners, builders, insurers, even the Federal Emergency Management Minister have all said, yes, we do. We need to rethink planning laws because of this.
So is this something that you're considering, you're thinking about at the moment? Should environmental and habitat risk play a bigger part in our planning laws? And what would happen if we had stricter rules on where we're allowed to build or rebuild?
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Good morning, Rochelle Hunt here with you in Melbourne. Bronwyn O'Shea joining you from ABC Wodonga. Do we think about our environment and habitat risk, climate risk, when we build large scale, even when we build small scale, say maybe building our own personal home? Do we take the environment into consideration enough? Let's go to Tony in Mount Waverley. Morning, Tony.
My history with climate change goes back to 81 when I did my master's in climate change at UNSW. When Suncor came to us in the Weather Bureau for a commercial risk analysis and changed their business model totally in the mid-90s, I thought I better start doing something about it personally. So I took 20 years to find a block of land, which I did in Eden in New South Wales in 2016. But sustainability is one thing, affordability is another.
Yes.
I budgeted $300K to build. It was a steep block. It's a beautiful block. But it was $450. It was the first quote. I didn't want to borrow at my age. The builder couldn't start in 2018. The fires hit in 2019. Now it's $900,000 to build that same house. So I'm still struggling to cope with the effects of climate change and the cost of housing. And ironically, climate change is what bit me.
Tony, you know, over the years, it sounds like this has been in the forefront of your mind for a really long time. Do you feel like we're playing catch up? Like, did you ever discuss the idea of building somewhere differently or thinking about the climate when it comes to building with friends or family, say 10 years ago? And did they, or did you have the same conversation with them then as you're having now?
Look, this goes back to Al Gore's comments in the late 70s, early 70s, I think it was. I was a metallurgist. I worked in the mines in WA. I joined the Weather Bureau to go to Antarctica. I was in the Weather Bureau for 30 years. So I have a lot of experience. I couldn't afford Eden, so I've purchased in Yay. With less of a risk analysis, there's some flood issues up there and fire. You know, my bushfire alert level in Eden's 12.5, which is about as low as you can get, whereas I'm in town in Yay, but, you know, Marysville told us that towns can burn, whole towns can burn. So there's risk associated. And when you say catch up, I mean, Exxon knew about this in 1930. We just, greed and capitalism, all these things are impacting on what we do because money's the driver.
Yeah. And Tony, how do we overcome that? You know, if ultimately it all comes down to whether or not you can afford to make these kinds of choices or factor these decisions into where you build, how do we overcome that hurdle?
Look, I think we have to step back from the problem and look at it in really large scale. Personally, I think capitalism is predicated on infinite growth on a finite planet with finite resources. Whether it's communist, socialist, capitalist, doesn't matter, or fascist. What we need is a socio-economic system that is sustainable and a political system that has the will to do it. 3-year political terms don't let you do anything constructive.
Good to hear from you, Tony. Thank you. And when we think about the cost associated, there's not just the cost of what it means to live somewhere that you feel isn't in a fire or flood prone area. I think cost comes into it a lot of the time because quite often when we look at building more homes, developers win, Bron, because it's about profit, and we will put profit over people, we will put it over place, and we will put it over the environment. And that needs to change. And I don't think it can always come under the guise of, well, we need to build more homes. Yes, we do, but we can't think in a short-sighted fashion. We have to think about, is this home good for the long term?
And look at the big picture cost, which is the cost of flood recovery and helping people into temporary housing if they're homeless because of a natural disaster. Not to mention, you know, the price we're all paying for the impacts of climate change. So when you start to look at the dollar and the part it plays in this, it gets complex, doesn't it?
It certainly does. But should environmental and habitat risk play a bigger part in our planning laws? When we think about where we build, how do we balance the need for more housing and the need to look after and to protect our climate and our environment? From small lizards through to coastal erosion, this is a really big and wide lens. Sarah Beckesy is a Professor of Sustainability and Urban Planning at RMIT University and also the lead counsellor of the biodiversity area in the Biodiversity Council. Sarah, that's a very long title and I completely stuffed it up, so apologies and good morning.
Not at all. Good morning. Thanks so much for having me on.
What do we need to consider when we build? Do we need to look at all aspects of the environment, and where do you start to do that?
Well, I mean, yes, we do need to look at the environment when we start to build. I mean, you know, we unfortunately, a lot of our most endangered ecosystems, including the one that the Eelas dragon has just been rediscovered in, are right on the edges of our cities, and they're the places that we're growing our cities out into with this kind of relentless or urban sprawl. And so it's the same for Melbourne, Sydney, Perth, Brisbane. We have really critically endangered ecosystems and species on the edges of our cities. So, I mean, I think fundamentally, you know, here we've got a really kind of extreme example. We've got this rediscovery of a dragon in Melbourne's backyard, essentially. We thought it was extinct. 1969 was the last time it was found. And, you know, was the headline, you know, previously extinct dragon found in Melbourne's backyard? No, the headline was lizard holds up 300,000.
Great point. You know, the framing of it, Sarah. Yeah, it's all about us, isn't it? Yeah,
that's right. So, you know, I think taking a step back as well and thinking, you know, what have we done to this landscape and to our ecosystems? This is an ecosystem that we've cleared. There's 1% of it left. It's a critically endangered grassland, beautiful ecosystem, absolutely steeped in Aboriginal culture, and also really significant for European Victorians in terms of the wealth that it provided for us. We should be absolutely romanticising, embracing, celebrating the fact that we've got this extraordinary ecosystem that's still just hanging on
And how much of that has got to do with urban sprawl? We keep building out instead of up, and that's a debate that we're really only starting to have quite deeply now. And when we look at some of our urban fringes, you know, someone who grew up in Gippsland, once upon a time, the distinction between the country and the city was really apparent, right? But now Berwick, Pakenham, all of those areas that were once considered the country are now considered a part of the city. We've got kangaroos and wildlife and all sorts of things that are making their way onto freeways, essentially, and onto highways. How do we balance the need? But people need homes, and they need affordable homes.
And that's where the affordable homes are, right? Out in those fringe areas.
I think that's a bit of a kind of myth, to be honest. I mean, if you look at the prices of those, I think there's a few things going on here. One, are they affordable? Not really. No, they're not cheap houses. They're really not. And then you move in there and you spend half your budget on transport because there's no public transport. There's no local facilities. So you're driving everywhere. No one in this world thinks that urban sprawl is a good solution to housing. And in fact, it's Labor's own policy now to move away from that. And why? Because it's not just bad for wildlife, for the Eelas dragon, for these things that we're going to send to extinction, even though we've committed internationally not to send things intentionally to extinction. But it's also bad for people. People don't have great lives living in urban sprawl.
So why are we still doing it, Sarah? Like, because I'm face-palming here thinking you're telling us all these things that are wrong with this approach. So why is it happening?
Yeah. So I think we really do need to rethink the way that we do urban development in this country. There are models even within Australia that we can look to, you know, sustainable mid-rise where you've got really great family-friendly, you know, environments that have maybe even semi-private shared beautiful green space. These are models that work in other countries. And
there's not as much money in that though, is there, Sarah?
Well, I mean, I think, are we doing this? If we've got to work out why are we doing this? Is it to make money for developers, or is it to deliver affordable housing? You know,
and who makes the decisions on that? I mean, there's so much love coming in for Tony, by the way, who just rang before. This it says Tony nailed it. The CSIRO gave local government all across Australia all of the climate data that they needed to build sustainably back in the 1990s. It was ignored. It was all removed from the CSIRO website. I feel really sorry for people and grandchildren. I feel like it's just too late now. Well, I don't think it's ever too late. But at the same time, do you feel like the climate is being ignored over the need for housing?
I mean, certainly it's not a good idea to be building houses where we know that there's really extreme fire risk and we know that there's really extreme flood risk. Now, grassland ecosystems are a perfect example. They're a highly flammable ecosystem. We shouldn't be building houses and putting people at risk in these environments. So it's another reason why we should be looking towards, you know, urban consolidation, brownfield sites. There's so many of them that we could be developing and producing genuinely affordable housing in places where people could access public transport, and actually then looking towards really preserving the critically endangered ecosystems that we are now imperiling.
Sarah, thank you so much. Sarah Beckersey, a Professor of Sustainability and Urban Planning at RMIT.
It's funny too, Bron, because when you think about, let's use the little lizard, right, the earless lizard, super cute. And then
super
you think,
cute.
Well, what's... I'm playing devil's advocate here, right? But you could think, well, what's the big deal, right? So we lose one lizard, but, you know, close to 350,000 families or individuals will get a home. At some point, has something got to give? But when you start to pull away at habitat loss, you lose one species, the flow-on effect of that species is generally probably going to be that another species is going to be impacted. The food chain, it's there for a reason.
And once you decide one doesn't matter, then where do you draw the line in the future? What about one more and one more? We're horrendously good at letting species go extinct in Australia.
And it depends on the species, right? And how cute the species is.
I liked what Sarah said about genuinely affordable. You know, and I think it's interesting, the purchase price or the build price for a property is not necessarily the long-term price or cost of that home either. Let's head to Preston. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. I live in an area near a creek, and we've just had a major building development down there, and we're losing vegetation at a rate of knots. And the bird counts are down, like the native birds. The traffic's become so terrible, and the birds are not used to this. And like I've found squashed beautiful native dove on the increased traffic. Mm. And the traffic has increased so much that it's almost untenable for the tenant. Park anywhere.
How has it changed the livability for you, Elizabeth?
Actually awful, and I also think we're in a bit of a hazard area because we're locked in. We've got the creek at the back of us, we've got the Vigiers Plenty Road running a bit further on, so we're locked, almost landlocked. So it's unsafe for humans as well. We're losing vegetation. And it's just becoming very unpleasant. And I do think that the people that are overseeing the, I don't know what they're called, the ones that sign off on a building, that some of them are a bit dodgy, to say the least.
Oh, good on you, Elizabeth. Thank you. Good to hear from you. But when you start to lose birds and you notice the difference of the bird life in your area, and if that's down to increase of traffic and increase of housing and development, what kind of impact does that have on you, and how far down the track do you look as well, and how much pressure is being put on to councils, to state government, to federal government to look at planning and development laws, and is the environment ever considered, like in the list of top 10 things, where does the environment come into this? I mean, we've just seen the West Gate at a standstill today because of climate protesters who were saying no one cares about the environment anymore. It's fallen off our radar. Housing has definitely risen to the top and we need that. But does that necessarily mean that the climate has to fall to the wayside? I'm not sure.
Love to hear what you think as we consider whether climate risk and environmental impact should play a bigger part in our planning laws.
Warren Cook is an environmental liaison officer at Inverloch Surf Life Saving Club. Warren, Inverloch has been under the spotlight for years now when it comes to coastal erosion. I know that they've potentially, I think I've lost track of the amount of times the Surf Life Saving Club has either been moved or potentially needs to be moved because of coastal erosion. Big picture, I mean, how long have Inverloch residents been considering the environment and the impact of the environment on locals?
Morning. Yes, about 8 years ago we noticed a big difference with the changing erosion that happened on the foreshore. And since then, in those probably 4 years leading up to it, we lost 70 metres of beach. And 70 metres of beach is quite a map, but also what happened is the high tide mark became about 10 metres from our life-saving club, but also it threatens housing in the area. So if we lose any more, we're going to be inundated in areas where they thought they were safe.
And Warren, you had kind of front row seats to all of this, didn't you? Because your home was right there overlooking that part of the beach where you saw that rapid erosion.
Well, not so much overlooking, but we're certainly in the area where it could be inundated by water if the tide came through and, probably 100, 200 houses would be under threat.
I haven't for a while, but I did spend a lot of time in Inverloch and down on the beach there. And the only way I could sort of describe the beach to Bron was I felt like Mother Nature was screaming in my face a little bit in terms of how the beach was reacting, whether it be all of the sandbags that were needed to protect the shoreline, to protect homes, the amount of seaweed that was being washed up. And it felt like it was almost sort of edging in onto the main road that wraps around the Esplanade there. Are locals feeling like they're being listened to when it comes to the importance of knowing where to build and how to find that balance between the need for housing but the need to listen to Mother Nature?
Well, look, it's been on the agenda for quite a few years now, and the government's put a research paper in place that was meant to take 2 years, and the findings were meant to be published and recommendations on what the next steps were. That sort of held up through COVID and then further on. So it's taken 4 or 5 years to actually do get the findings through to the minister, but unfortunately the minister's got them and it hasn't been released yet. So there's three things we wanted in the report. One was action, urgency, recommendations, and we've got nothing. And it's really frustrating because the community sort of left out to dry and don't know where the next steps are.
Mm. And Warren, you've taken action yourself, haven't you? You've moved to higher ground.
I have, yes. Into town a little bit and up on the hill, only because I see that the long-term effect, if nothing is done, is going to affect that area.
What would you like done?
Look, first of all, I'm not an expert. The experts are being paid large sums of money to come up with recommendations, and there's been several put up. You know, there's been artificial reefs, groins to be installed, a rock wall put in. So, look, all great recommendations, but we need action. So I'm not saying one over the other, but certainly we need to do something because at the moment we're in a lull. Mother Nature's taken a rest. Probably the last 3 years we've seen the erosion stop. But with environmental changes comes weather patterns that are quite aggressive, and we've seen tidal surges that can really make a big difference. And like I said, that can change any minute when Mother Nature decides, well, yeah, it's time to take the next step.
Just finally, Warren, would you like to see almost a hold on any new builds in places like Inverloch?
Well, look, you know, it depends on the area. They do have a floodplain that they've built on an area where, you know, it will be inundated. I don't think there's any areas left that's probably low-lying, so I'm not sure that's an answer. But, you know, again, more people who pay bigger money than me sort of know what to do.
Warren, it's great to get your perspective as a resident and someone who's, you know, passionate about making sure you can remain a resident there, let's face it, into the future. Thanks so much for joining us on The Conversation Hour. Warren Cook, who has the position of Environmental Liaison Officer at the Inverloch Surf Lifesaving Club. I've never heard of that position in a surf lifesaving club before.
I wonder whether that will become...
Says a lot.
More common. Plenty of texts on this and lots of people referencing back to the huge climate protest that was on the Westgate Bridge this morning. If you're living in regional Victoria and you haven't heard too much about it, the Westgate was at a standstill. It was taking people a couple of hours to move a couple of Ks, and it was all in the name of a climate protest. So lots of people saying that despite how annoying blocking traffic can be, after seeing the images of recent fires in the Grampians and hearing about my friend's emergency evacuation, I can understand why people take this kind of action. I hope the right people, though, around are listening. That's from Freya, who's in West Footscray. And another that says, I was stuck in the traffic on the Westgate this morning from the activists, but I don't care. I took the time to think about the climate crisis and what I'm doing and what the government isn't doing. We need more people like those guys. And lots of people talking about the councils and whether or not the councils are still just allowing too many builds and are pushing too far out into urban areas. Peter's in Kilmore, I think. Hi, Peter.
Yep, hi. Look, a lot of your callers have got it terribly wrong. It's Victoria, for argument's sake. There's provisions in a state planning scheme and councils have to go along with the state planning scheme. And each council has its own planning scheme, subsidiary off that state planning scheme. And there is a plethora of overlays, environmental overlays, vegetation protection overlays, erosion overlays, salinity overlays, design and development overlays. It's got to the point we've got so much green and red tape that this notion of housing affordability is out the door, because there is, it's 6 months now, 9 months, 12 months to get planning approval because there's so many overlays and conditions.
So you're saying as a town planner, let me see if I got this right, that as a town planner, let's say you're planning a new suburb, you know, 20 Ks out of Melbourne CBD, there's so much red tape with concerns about the environment that it's taking too long to build the homes and as a result it's pushing prices up.
Well, I'm saying it's pushing prices up, but what I'm saying to you is that there are so many mechanisms in place now to protect the environment that for people to say that it's being thrown out the door and that there's nothing done to protect the environment is totally incorrect, because there's so much there in place at the moment to protect the environment.
So, do you think, Peter, it's too much, or have we got the balance right at the moment? Do you think we're okay?
I think we've got the balance right, but unfortunately, out of the 78 municipalities in Victoria, and just about every town planning department now are working from home, you can't get a response. The statutory period for response to town planning applications is meant to be 60 days. I've had examples of 8, 9, 10, 12 months, even when you provide the information. And there's more rules and more regulations.
Is that not a good thing, though? I mean, it's not great for the price of houses, but... You know, what's the red tape? Is it like big concerns around, is it a flood-prone area, or is it at the impact on habitat loss? What's the red tape?
All of those things are included. So if, for argument's sake, it was a development, a large-scale, a small subdivision, whatever development, a planning consultant would address every single component, every overlay that's listed in for that land, and address all of those concerns. There'd be land management plans, environmental management plans, all those things to address the overlay. So all of that, all of those regulations, they are there, and they are very strong regulations. What I'm saying to you is that the balance is there for the regulations, but if you've got people not doing their job and not getting through the work, you got these delayed. It doesn't take...
And that's what pushes them up. I wonder too, and towards the end of the program, we'll speak to Jonathan Spear, the CEO of Infrastructure Victoria, and a lot of what they're saying at the moment is we actually need to look at more so where we're building. So like Peter, as a town planner, Bron, you know, lots of red tape because we're pushing out into these areas where there is habitat, where there is huge climate concerns. So if we shifted where we build, maybe there wouldn't be as much red tape. Do we need denser CBDs?
Great question to ask Jonathan Spear and our next guest, Mark Maund, who is with the School of Architecture and Built Environment and works in this field as well. So keep those questions and thoughts coming.
So do we consider the environment enough when we build, when we rebuild either our homes and when we create new suburbs? Are we taking our climate and the environment into consideration?
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Good morning, Rochelle Hunt here in Melbourne. Bronwyn O'Shea joining you from ABC Wodonga. Do we consider habitat and environment enough when we build? From the earless dragon, the little lizard, through to coastal erosion, Bron.
Yeah, and there's lots of comments coming in on text in response to Peter's chat with us just now. Someone here says, Peter is absolutely right. Council have so many factors to deal with that they can't make decisions, and that's from Rob the architect. But this from Chris says, council planners just ignore environmental significance overlays. That is fact. And another here says, developers do whatever they want regardless of the conditions of the permit because council will never follow through on the conditions imposed.
And the interesting thing that we have too is every council having their own different laws and needs and regulations. So you have to start to wonder, Bron, if it's ever possible, and we'll go into this with our next guest in just a moment, whether we need federal laws here, just one law, right? Or at least a handful, like, and not different laws depending on where you live and the recommendations there. And then that's when you're going to get councils and developers taking control.
I feel like every second conversation hour we have is about why don't we have a national law about this?
Exactly.
George has phoned into the conversation hour from Mornington. Hello, George. Welcome.
Hi. Look, we're in a position on the Mornington Peninsula where we've got bushland reserves and so on. We've been here for 30 years. The houses that we built, or at that time, were small, had the environment involved. Now we've got these huge, ostentatious buildings, mansions, that one's doing better than the other, and it blocks out the environment.
What have you noticed change? How long have you lived on the peninsula, George?
Well, we came to Mornington in 1958.
Wow.
And the block that we're on, we had wire fences between houses so the native animals could... venture through and pass through our blocks and so on. We have so much loss of our flora and fauna because of putting up barriers between each house. You know, a simple thing like putting up a wooden fence stops the animals from coming through.
It must have changed your lifestyle a lot. I mean, not only has it changed habitat, but that's almost going from a rural lifestyle to a suburban lifestyle.
Yeah. Look, and a community, people are locking themselves in these huge mansions and they're not interacting with each other and being a community. Like, to me, that's what people are striving for. I don't see why.
Yeah, and I think the fence has got a lot to do with that. This, it says, don't build out, build up. Mark Maund is an adjunct senior lecturer at the School of Architecture and Built Environment. He's at the University of Newcastle. Mark, are we getting it right anywhere, do you think, when it comes to planning and restrictions and guidelines of where we can build? Are we protecting the environment and looking after human beings at the same time anywhere in Australia, do you think?
Hey, Rochelle Grolland, great to talk to you. Are we doing it right? The one of the challenges, I guess, around this conversation, it's been really interesting hearing everyone speak. Everyone obviously has a different view on what getting it right means. Some people have a greater focus on the environment. Some people understand housing affordability and the need to house people that currently don't have homes. And all of these are really important issues. The big challenge in planning, obviously, is finding that balance, which some of your callers have talked about. So finding that balance, what does that balance look like? What is getting it right mean? I do think a focus on the environment is particularly important. But then when you do that, as you've hinted at, I guess if you put more emphasis on the environment, which is something we should do, we then, I guess, lose the option to increase our urban sprawl. We know fundamentally that urban sprawl isn't great at longer travel times. Our people are a bit isolated, as your last caller said. But then you revert to the option of higher density. Some people really don't like living in units, living in higher density environments. So this is all the conversations, I guess, we were all having and will continue to have in terms of what does getting it right look like.
How do socioeconomics play into this, Mark? Because we've had a few people talk about the fact that with a greater consideration of climate impact, risk, habitat loss, probably your pockets need to get deeper and deeper the harder you think about those things. Is that fair?
So, I mean, yes, it's really a challenge in terms of socioeconomics. As we know, housing is expensive and infrastructure is more expensive. Where we live, choose to live, obviously informs how much we pay. So economics is a really big issue in terms of this context. There's also, and it's not really the right term in terms of the environment, but there's an opportunity cost. So if you choose not to move into habitat and, damage that habitat, then that land is preserved in future. But that land is then not able to be developed. Again, the advantage to that, and you can value the environmental outcomes of that, so there is a positive. But as you reduce that ability to develop some of that land, the cost of land in other areas goes up as well. So the socioeconomics is a really challenging part of this housing discussion.
The idea of having one or two, or at least three, right? So no more than five. Okay, let's even say no more than five laws that everyone in Australia has to abide by when it comes to finding a way to benefit both human beings and the environment and our climate, because we need to build more homes, but how do we do it properly? There's a text here that says having a national scheme would not be beneficial to the ecosystems or to the environment because accountability is different and those planners are just doing their job. Money talks, unfortunately. And lots of people actually talking about, well, people just pay their way out of a lot of these potential risks. Do you have concerns that money talks? So even if there was to be another earless dragon or another potential habitat that was going to be impacted in some way, that if your pockets are deep enough, then let's not worry about it so much.
So I think as a general rule, we do need to have faith in the system. So in terms of having a national approach, there is the Environment Protection and Biodiversity Conservation Act. That is a national act that seeks to protect the environment. There is, a gap in the national discussion on this in that there's no national planning body. That each state has a planning body and we have local government, but there is no national overarching approach to this. So I do think that is a gap.
Why would that be, sorry to interrupt, Mark, but why would that be beneficial? Because I know lots of people say, oh, that's just another layer of bureaucracy, you know, if you have a national level planning body. Why would that be advantageous?
So in my view, it all comes back to consistency. So really having a consistent approach where we've talked about different areas have different requirements. If you have a national approach and a national strategy around housing, a national strategy around protecting the environment, then you all have a common ground and a common starting point. The planning is very local, and individual communities should be allowed to help decide on how their community develops. That's really important. But having a national approach with national objectives and guidelines that everyone can refer to, I think is really important. And then you have that different lens in terms of, well, the country of Australia needs more housing. How do we meet that target? So yeah, I think it is a much more all-inclusive approach, having a national body and approach to that.
Mark, what about, we've talked a lot about going into new areas or expanding an urban sprawl. What about the places that we're already living in? And I'm thinking here post-disaster, when we see a push for, you know, home buybacks in flood-prone areas or high bushfire risk areas, and people tossing up, you know, do I stay and rebuild or do I leave? And often that has a lot to do with what they can afford. Do we need to see changes in laws around where we already live?
And this is one of the big challenges we do have to deal with. So this is the legacy planning decisions where people have been allowed or chosen to live in these areas, and a number of things have happened over time. Either hazards, the impact of hazards has increased, or through climate change, where those hazards affect buildings has also changed. So this is a really difficult decision because for a couple of reasons. We have strong community feelings in particular areas, like for instance in Lismore, there is a community there that lives there, they know each other, and in essence they want to stay in that location. However, it is dangerous. So in terms of staying in flood prone areas or bushfire prone areas that are high risk, we do need to generally as a principle move people out of those areas. So trying to maintain that social construct while also moving people to a new location is really challenging. It's also really expensive to move entire communities. So these legacy decisions are something that all of us need to work with. They're also something that individuals will struggle with a lot. So for instance, if your home is in a hazard-prone area or it has been damaged, the cost of picking up and moving to a completely different location is quite significant for individuals. So this again comes down back to that national approach of helping each other.
And it's also learning from history as well. I wonder, let's take the Lismore example just finally, Mark. Is the issue there of looking at trying to relocate and potentially buy back an entire community, is that because a community was built in an area where it never should have been built in the first place? Or is it because of a slow progression of climate change that we're now seeing environments where locals will become climate refugees?
So it's a little bit of both across Australia. I think some of the decisions were made, we have to assume that the best interests of people were made when these decisions for where to live at the time. People rely on the best available information. So definitely the risk of natural hazards has increased over time. We also have a lot better data now that we can use to rely on to make these decisions. So it's easy to look back on decisions someone made 50 years ago and think, why did they decide to live there? However, we have much better data now. So I think it's more, again, gaining that information, sharing that knowledge over time. And I think it's really just making better decisions into the future is really what we should focus on.
Mark, thanks so much. Mark Maund, Adjunct Senior Lecturer, School of Architecture and Built Environment at the University of Newcastle.
Something interesting that Mark was just saying there, like, yes, we need a national approach, but at the same time, we have to give councils permission to react to their own needs. And there's, I guess, a negative way of looking at that, going, okay, well, they're just going to be in the hands of developers and it's all just going to be about money. But then there are some really great examples where local councils have made changes to bylaws and to all sorts of things to fit the needs of their community. So I'm thinking tiny homes, for example. There are councils dotted all around regional and rural Victoria now where they're saying, okay, for 12 months you can put one on your property, you can have one in your driveway. They are changing laws and local laws to be able to fit to their community needs. So that's just one example of an area that won't need to push out and, you know, create an estate around their town if we allow more tiny homes, if that's what you want, because I know that's a debate within itself, but if that's what you and the community want, then that's an instant change that can occur.
That's exactly right. And, you know, that saying of it's no one size fits all, and that's the whole point, isn't it, of having local government have some autonomy and be able to look into the nuances of the communities where they live. A few texts here. The climate protesters are doing the only sane and rational thing. We're all frogs boiling in a pot. And this text from Nev says, what's wrong with terrace housing? Who doesn't love a terrace? Better use of space, heating and cooling are more efficient, and you get community.
Nick in Edith Vale says, this week I've been looking at old family photos from the 1920s. They're from my great aunt's holiday house in Boronia. So that's where they went on holidays. It's bush and it's farmland. The outward sprawl has been with us for over a century. We're going to put all of this to Dr. Jonathan Spear, the CEO of Infrastructure, in just a moment. But Greg's in beautiful Yarragon. Hi, Greg.
How are you going?
Good, mate. What's going on?
I'm a civil engineer. I've been 40-odd years in the field, and I'm finding that we're getting a lot more subdivisions being built in areas that are flood-prone or going to be flood-prone, because the fact is that we're building denser houses. We're creating a lot more runoff than we ever used to and what the land was ever used to. So the waterways and the existing old drainage aren't ever designed for those type of
So as a civil engineer, Greg, when you see a plan and you think, okay, this is being built on a floodplain, whether people realise it or not, what kind of reaction do you get from those? I'm imagining a boardroom table and the people sitting around, people go, okay, well, we better scrap this idea. Or do people think, oh, well, bad luck, we've got no other choice?
What I find is that the developers quite often have got a lot of money invested in it, and they will employ people which will back up there saying, oh, the drainage is all fine. When I check it through, and, you know, as I say, I've got a lot of experience, it doesn't stack up. And it
Do
means
you get listened to? Are you listened to?
There are people that are starting to listen to it, but there are a lot of people that say, oh, no, it's all too hard, stick their head in the sand. And the problem is the people that are actually making the decisions in council planners have absolutely no idea about drainage and how it works.
And they're not the ones living there, Greg, either, are they? And that's what I wonder, how clear is it? If you're going to go and buy a home in one of these new developments, who tells you, or how clear is it? Do people know what they're buying into if that home is being built on a floodplain?
Sometimes they do, because sometimes the councils will have a flood overlay maps as part of their planning ordinance, and that will tell it. But as for instance in the Baulbourshire, they were proposing to implement such a mapping system or update it, and they then turned around and said, no, we're not going to do it. So the people that are buying these properties that get their Section 32 document have got absolutely no idea that they're actually going to be building in the flood-prone area.
See, that's interesting, isn't it? Because people don't know, right? And all of the due diligence has apparently been done. But if you don't know you're buying in a flood-prone area or buying on a floodplain, and then you experience a flood or down the track, you can't get insurance, all of the things that come along with this, it's
all
not the buyer's fault.
Going up to the point where they can't afford it. And or the other one is, and I've seen a lot of it, is where they, when they do the subdivision, they create the street layout such that the water will, because what most people don't realise is the pipe drainage system is only designed for low-level floods, floods that, you know, occur once in 5 years or thereabouts.
I wonder too how much of it, Greg, is to do with, well, look, we're going to get this across the line because it seems like we need more housing, and we're just going to find a way. And by the time it becomes an issue, I won't be in this position anymore, and it won't be my problem.
Yeah, well, that's part of it. But, you know, we have a responsibility to the people that are going to buy these houses, because that's the most important investment they're ever going to make in their life.
Of course it is, and it's huge as well. Oh, wow. Jonathan Spear has been listening to a lot of this. Of course, he is the CEO of Infrastructure Victoria. Jonathan, when you sit down and you look at where we need to build and what we need to build, how high up on the list of importance does our environment, does habitat, and does everything from fire and flood, just impacts on the environment, how much of that comes into your thinking?
It's a really important consideration, Rochelle, and thanks for the opportunity to be with you again this morning. We've been looking over the last couple of years, we've been doing research at the future shape of our cities, because we're going to have about 1 million more people coming to Victoria every decade for the next 3 decades, and they've got to go somewhere. And a lot of our reliance in recent decades to accommodate that growth has been to continue to sprawl at the edges of Melbourne, our regional cities. What we've looked at is, well, different scenarios, different choices that we might have about the way our cities grow in future. And one of the things we've definitely looked at is, what impact does that have on the environment and on agricultural land? And if we continue to sprawl the way we have been, we're probably going to use around 70,000 more hectares of land for new development.
Wow.
Whereas if we have a more compact city, it might be something more like 40,000 hectares. So that's about 12,000 times the MCG that's in play for us to make a choice about.
So when you say compact city, are you just talking about Metro Melbourne, or are you talking about a more compact Bendigo, a more compact Ballarat?
We have an opportunity before us to have more compact cities throughout Victoria. And Infrastructure Victoria's research shows that more compact cities will give us better social, environmental and economic outcomes, and make a lot better use of our infrastructure as well. And so over recent decades, more than half of our growth has been happening at the edges of our cities. But about 1 in 3 Victorians who are living in those places, in those greenfield areas of our cities in Geelong, Ballarat, Bendigo and Melbourne, tell us they would actually rather live in an established area, in a townhouse or an apartment, but they don't have the housing choice. So that's a real opportunity for us, is to reshape the way we grow. So if you want to live at the edge of a city, that's fine, but it shouldn't be the only choice.
So how do we incentivise or make sure that there are those options then? Because obviously they're not there at the moment for home buyers.
That's right. So we need to make a number of changes. So we need to be very clear in our regional cities about what our growth boundaries are going to be, because many of them don't have a growth boundary the way Melbourne does. Mm. We need to change our planning laws so that it is much more certain to be able to develop high quality design, low rise apartments and townhouses in the established areas of our suburbs. And we need to stop giving people first homeowner grants that actually encourage them to build new homes at the edges of our cities, because unfortunately those grants don't actually make the homes cheaper. They just go into the pockets of developers. There's lots of research that shows that.
Jonathan, one of the factors though, if we talk about building up our cities, I know we haven't really touched on it yet, but heat waves are deadly, and that is another thing that we are facing with a changing climate. Yeah. is this challenge of heat waves. And I've seen, the warnings about our cities getting hotter and hotter, and the need to be building in green zones and thinking about how we keep growing cities cool. So, how much consideration is that being given in what you're talking about?
Oh, that's absolutely the case. So we think of tree canopy cover as infrastructure for our cities. And we have recommended to the Victorian government that there be increased requirements to plant tree canopy, especially in some of those new developing areas. And it's really pleasing to see that the Victorian Planning Authority's guidelines for new suburbs actually now requires 30% or more tree canopy cover. So that's really important. The other side of this, of course, is if we allow our communities and cities to expand at the edges of our cities, it does tend to expose more Victorians to the risks of extreme heat and also things like fires and flood on the edges of our cities, including our regional cities. So that's a real consideration for us.
Are you being listened to, Jonathan? Do you think that this message is being heard at all?
Yeah, yes, it is. And so this year there's a really big opportunity as the Victorian government updates its planning strategy. It said that it's going to issue a new plan for Victoria. And that's a really big opportunity to reset the planning settings and the ambition for the future shape of Victoria. And what our research shows is that seeking to have more compact cities and open up more housing choice will get us better results, but it'll also mean that more Victorians, particularly Victorians who've got a moderate income, have a greater choice about where they want to live and work. And that's something that we can definitely do better on, but the choice is before us now to make changes to our policy and planning settings and our tax settings and grants that will all set us up for the future where we have more compact cities that give us better results and, to go to where you started, don't consume as much valuable agricultural and environmental land at the edges of our cities.
Where we can live side by side with the earless dragon and that it doesn't have to be one or the other. Jonathan Spear, as always, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
CEO of Infrastructure Victoria. So many texts on this. So apologies if we didn't read it out, but here's just one, which is probably a good one to end on. It says, thank you for this conversation. Critical for some basic climate standards to be established to ensure that all new and renovated developments are climate resilient and future proof. It would help create economies of scale, will bring down costs, things like no black roofs, minimum installation standards, integration of green infrastructure, water retention, solar panels, shading, etc., etc. The solutions are available, but it's all about money. We need a big shift on this. And a lot of it does come down to money. Where are we? How much money are developers making? How cheaply can we afford to build these homes? The first home buyers grant that Jonathan brought into it. And then all of this, a lot of the time, comes at the expense of our climate and our environment and our habitat. I don't know what the answer is, Bron. I feel like it was a really, really big and scary conversation.
I think the answer is something has to change, but quite what that looks like is yet to be determined.
Starting to see the reason why the Westgate was held up today. I feel like there's lots of people screaming, saying we need to have a conversation about the climate and how it impacts all of our lives. Don't forget, the Conversation Hour is also a podcast. Subscribe to the Conversation Hour. Chat to you tomorrow.